Now I'll introduce Lynn Turner again, who's going to talk about the future and the past and what we've learned and what we should learn and all things from Vermont.
Ice cream.
Hi. Morning. Dan's here. The traffic's on its way. When I get here. So, you know, what I'm not going to do a lot of talk right now. There's a lot of detail, like, I don't know how many of you were thinking this when Matthew was talking, but I was really noticing a parallel process between what you do with the patient and what each of you needs to do with your system of care or that organization. So the question is, you know, what we have interventions that can work in this domain, and the one that we typically talk about is motivational interviewing. And I was thinking, you know, so why isn't a priority for those sites that are way below the hit rate for screening? What's going on and why isn't a priority? And so it's really your task, if you're the expert coordinator or the expert implementer, it would be your task to really try to figure out how you can motivate your sites. And I'll talk about a few things that we learned yesterday. So the first thing I want to do is go back for a second in time, because my theme for the day is really going to be what are the lessons learned, both individually, on a systems level, on a patient level. So let's just go back in time for a minute. I can see many of you are a little bit glassy-eyed right now. And what I want to do is try to reverse that trend. And I think the best way to do that would be if literally you just stretch your arms up in the air. Just follow me on this. You might not like it. You can get annoyed at me. Stretch your arms up in the air. Take a deep breath. Let's welcome a new section of the day. You're going to learn a lot today about your own programs as well as about what ESPR can do and what it is doing in the future. So here's a question for you from yesterday, and just I'm going to get you to throw out words. What were some of the lessons that you learned from both my presentation and Dan's presentation? If you think about any, you know, word or lesson that stuck with you, let me just call and pick on you. What was one of the words that, were you here yesterday?
Yeah.
What was one of the words, I don't want to pick on you, you weren't. So what was one of the words that you learned, you know, that sticks out in your mind from yesterday? Any of them?
I would say medication.
Medication is?
It's a viable treatment for addiction.
It's an effective intervention for addiction. And that really tells you that it also has some disease component, right? That's sort of one of the hints that we're saying, that means that it really is a chronic. And another word that stuck out from yesterday. Yeah, anybody in your room, but you're great, that'd be perfect.
All right, well, what really stuck out in my mind is when he made the comparison for diabetic patients to substance abuse patients was actually higher, but the diabetes patients were treated
without stigma, and they were treated within the hospital setting. All right, how about this real? Can I pick on this real for a second? What stood out in your mind as being important to you? It's your lesson learned. So that's what will you take away? Forget the paper stuff, but what will you take away from what you heard?
I think that triggered the most conversation for us in the room was kind of the entire idea of the medication management, or medication management component of the that part really was at the end of this
discussion. So pharmacotherapy, they call it, is really important. So one of the things to think about, and many of you are latching on to the power of those medications, is what's the chance that your patients will adhere to the medication? So what the cardiologists know is those regimens are not followed very well, typically. And so, you know, he started talking about Vivitrol and medications that are injectable, because I think most people on Suboxone try to adhere. You know, they seem to get enough out of it, and particularly if they've bought into recovery. But it's good. Sounds like all of you sort of had many of you had eye-openers that this is the wave of the future. Yeah,
Bruce. One of the things I've heard several times from you and from Dr. Benson and Dr. Brown is that
one of the things I heard from all of you yesterday was that this is really a cumulative work. It's a lot of very brief interventions over time. It's not something that you do once or twice to a patient And to me, that's somewhat the antidote to the challenge of time. Everybody complains about not having enough time. Well, do you have a minute? Because a minute over several visits or over a year or over 2 years can have the impact. And I think that's what everybody seemed to be saying yesterday.
Yeah, and what's nice about that is the data shows that what's really effective when you're working with chronic relapsing brain disorders is continued care. But Bruce just said this, continued care management. You've heard of that, right? People don't just get over their diabetes. They don't just get over their addictions. Continued care. All right, so I just want to key in on a couple things that I missed yesterday and the lessons learned that I was sort of thinking at what was really important. If someone wants to understand how to define addiction, I think a good term to use is biopsychosocial. I hope that word sticks out in your mind because it's definitely influenced from many areas. And that often carries across the stigma of it as well, and it shouldn't. It's just one of the typical myths that, you know, I think was almost here in words but wasn't clearly stated that you see often is that addictions are voluntary and that, you know, you can stop at any time you want. And it turns out because of the brain disease component and the physiological components, it's not that simple. And that's why these medications are effective, because they help people make that choice to stop. The other thing we talked about that you all need to actually capitalize on, even though I didn't say it very well, is do you remember when I talked about positive expectancies yesterday? That based on beer commercials, even before you sip a beer, you already think it's going to be fun and you're going to be sexier and everything else, right? That's part of your image, and that's called a positive expectancy. Well, the power of that expectancy is what we use as psychologists. We sometimes call it transference, but it's really our referential authority. It's sort of saying, this is going to work for you. I'm certain of it. Your confidence as an expert clinician goes a long way. When you're in doubt about the power of medications for this disorder, or when you're in doubt about whether someone can be in recovery, and you sort of start saying, well, relapse is a part of recovery, you're going to relapse, you know, when you talk like that, it takes away the power. And so what we want to tell you is that this sets you up. Anytime you can give a rationale, meaning this medication is effective for 50% of the people who take it, or this medication is effective for 20%, still a lot. This medication is very effective. When you can give rationales and you give them clearly, that sets up a positive expectation. And that is a part, a very deep part of human psychology. So you just need to follow that. That's why the placebo effect works. You know, it's strong. The placebo effect is very strong. So whatever you do with your patient, give rationales. Say, you know, whatever you do with your organization, give the rationale. The reason why maybe organizations aren't screening for ESPR, the reason they're not screening for alcohol and drug use is maybe they don't believe it really matters. Still, so you need to continually inform them that it works. Give the rationale. Does that make sense? And that comes back to the human psychology. The other part that I was thinking about was we talked a lot about situational factors influencing human behavior, right? So you should also know that in early recovery, if your patient has decided to take steps, one of the best strategies is avoidance. And that's because of the power of the situation. You understand that the cues and the triggers within the situation are so strong that if they don't avoid them, they might use. So I'm just saying, in the back of your toolbox as an addiction expert, you just know that their chances are much greater is if they use avoidance. Is that clear? And not go into the bar for several months until the cues and the triggers, the stimulus response, reactions are slower, right? Okay, so then the only other thing I wanted to do really is just give you the seven words that I think are really powerful for the clinician in a field where we're turning more and more to motivational interventions and also cognitive skill interventions. And I've said these before in a training here, but I don't know if they came out as yesterday, and that'll be the end of my sort of summary from yesterday's lessons learned. But motivational interviewing is really about readiness. It's about willingness, and it's about ability. You have to feel like you can do it. So those words, when someone says, how do you do motivational interviewing, you should think about ready, willing, and able. And that's true even for your organization, right? Is your organization ready? Well, if they're not, you have to stage your expert intervention. What do you have to do to prove to them that expert works? And then they get more ready, whoever the practice manager is. If they really see that expert works, they maybe will be more willing to put expert into place and seriously start screening. Does that make sense? And then they have to feel like they know how to use EBERT or EASBERT, right? They have to feel like they have the ability to do it. There's enough staff or, you know, enough frontline people, or there's the tools are easy to use, they're part of the workflow. Does that make sense on an organization? So ready, willing, able. Once they're there, once your patient is saying, you know what, maybe I should take a look at this, and I'm actually willing to do something this week different, like cut back, that's when the words awareness, right, avoidance, maybe it's because it's...
No, go turn off the
other microphone.
No, I didn't.
Awareness.
That's Matthew's leftover, right? Explain it.
How do you turn it on?
Push and hold.
Push and hold, there's two buttons.
Yeah. Well,
I'm going to push and hold it. I can mute it.
Are you able?
I'm willing to.
I got it. Thanks. So, aware, avoid, cope, and replace. So, those are the words that we use that sort of define cognitive behavioral skills interventions. But if somebody can become aware of their triggers and not necessarily jump into them, become aware of those things, they can avoid them, and then they just have to tolerate not having them because you replace them with other dopaminergic activities. Right? When you saw Valiant's study yesterday, replacement activities are a key part of recovery. People still need to have joy in their lives, and they need to have as much, if not more, than people who have sort of this addictive gene. You might need dopamine, you might have like a dopamine need that's greater than people just walking around that don't have that need. Alright, so those are some of the lessons learned from yesterday. It seems like the medication was a very powerful one. You still have to get people to take the medication, and for that you've got to use your motivational interviewing skills, right, and have them become collaborative partners with them. And that's true across many fields. Cardiology, right? It's not just addiction medicine, right? Many fields where there's chronic disease management.